Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Secular Foxhole Podcast. It is we're recording this on the 19th of May, 2022, and today we have what I like to refer to as our resident philosopher, James Valiant, is here today to discuss three serious issues that have already been in the news, but I think we want to get a we're looking for an objectivist take on these issues. And let's, James, how are you?
I'm quite well. I'm quite well. How are you, Blair?
I'm doing great. I'm actually starting to get a sore throat, I think, but I have some water here with me, and I'm going to try to plow through this without.
You know, I'm loquacious, so I'll probably.
I'll ask a question and let you go.
As you know, I tend to go on a bit.
But everything you say is worth listening to, frankly.
Oh, thank you.
All right, but James, this staggeringly horrible thing, the leak of the, the decision apparently, or possibly the decision on Roe versus Wade, not only was it just like a few sentences or a couple of, you know, a page, it was the entire document was leaked.
Yeah.
What do you see happening to like the rule of law, even to the Supreme Court itself, when something like this horrible, this major break of decorum, if that's even the right word?
Well, I think I'd use a much stronger term than decorum. It is all fundamentally a threat of altering the American constitutional system as we know it. You know, until my lifetime, until say 30 some years ago, appointment of Supreme Court justices and federal appellate judges in general was considered to be sort of above politics. And senators would approve or disapprove a president's nomination based on either their qualifications or some very major issue about the person that transcended mere philosophical differences. They just expected that the president's, you know, it would tend to go the president's way. And judges, even conservative judges, sort of regarded themselves as independent of politics. I would say progressive left-wing justices began to more and more recognize that they were entering a realm of specific ideology and cutting loose from the foundations of the Constitution. But both sides had, to some degree, an understanding that the Supreme Court was above political considerations. And this is important for very many reasons. We do not live in a democracy in the United States, nor did our Constitution set up a democracy.
Correct.
Very limited powers were given to the federal government, and the Bill of Rights begins with the bold words, Congress shall make no law. So no majority, no Democratic majority, however big, could violate fundamental liberties that individuals enjoyed under the Bill of Rights. And the Supreme Court is our main protector of that. If they don't stand above politics, if they really are just another political agency like Congress or the president, selected by, in some way, the will of the people, then we have changed fundamentally our constitutional structure. And that, as I say, began in the 1980s, probably with the nomination of Judge Bork to the Supreme Court, which was thwarted by people like Senator Kennedy. And suddenly now political philosophy came on the map for justices. And ever since then, it's become increasingly so. And distressingly so, they've become more politicized. The recent efforts to try and the idea that they would increase the number of justices, and bless their hearts, left and right justices have agreed that it should stay at 9. I myself would advocate a constitutional amendment would fix the number at 9, even though the Constitution gives the power to Congress to determine the number of justices who sit on the court. But their lifetime appointments, precisely because we want them to be independent of political pressures. And now we have this. The security of conversations that go on between members of the Supreme Court and their staff is vital, is absolutely vital. And this is an unprecedented break. Normally what happens is the Supreme Court will hear cases in the autumn and in the winter, and then they will issue their decisions very frequently in June, sometimes May, June, about this time of year, most of the time in June.
Okay.
And in this case, what they'll do, their normal procedure after hearing oral arguments, This case was heard in December that challenges Roe versus Wade. You know, there's a state law that says that bans most abortions after 15 weeks, still pre-viability, but 15 weeks. And the Supreme Court has said viability is the test. So after hearing the case, what they'll do is they'll take an initial vote of the justices normally, and then they'll start assigning opinions, who will write the opinions on each side based on that initial vote. This appears to be the entire draft opinion for a majority opinion. Now, it is a draft opinion. When they first write, and it is the whole opinion, and in the entire history of the Supreme Court, there's never been a leak like this of an entire opinion. Maybe an idea was leaked that might be going one way or another, or some portion, as you say, some line or something might be leaked. But this is the first time an entire opinion was leaked. And on such an explosively emotional and volatile issue, it was destined to have a huge public impact, this leak, no doubt about it. But it is still just a draft opinion. Now, it does indicate that the majority is probably leaning towards upholding the state law that restricts abortion in this case. And the opinion was drafted, I think, in February and leaked just a month and a half ago?
Yes, roughly, yeah.
And so it's very distressing to see this sort of security and integrity, privacy and confidentiality of deliberations of the Supreme Court further politicized in such a rank way in a desperate attempt to influence the outcome. The only way whoever leaked this, we can only think that first they were violating all kinds of protocols, maybe even federal law in doing this, because federal documents are protected. In my view, if they ever do find this person should be forever barred from practicing law in the United States. And the Supreme Court can do that. This is a tremendous breach of protocol that threatens the apolitical status and the credibility that the Supreme Court has as being above politics. It's a direct assault on that and a direct attempt to politically influence what should be an apolitical decision of law. I find it perhaps the most distressing development in a series of developments over the last three decades or so that has politicized the court, tremendously altered it. We're already seeing most Republicans senators have now joined the chorus of voting based on political ideology. They sort of had to, because the Democrats were voting on ideological lines, as I say, starting with Bork back in the 80s. Now there's only a handful of senators that say it should still be independent of politics and ideology.
Let me jump in just for a second. I want to get this thought up before I forget it. I should have saved the article that I saw, because it disappeared just as quickly as it came. This was like 2, possibly 3 weeks ago, where this gentleman said, and this is unsubstantiated, but apparently it had a little bit of legs to it, but it was one of the legal aides of Justice Sotomayor that leaked it. But again, that article disappeared as fast as it appeared.
If I had a guess, and this is just a guess, and it is somewhat speculative on my part, I would think it would be one of the clerks of one of the left-leaning justices, because they, for a couple of reasons, they would know that there would be an outcry of the kind we've seen over the last month, frankly.
Yes.
Protesters going to justices' homes, which, you know, there's a law that says you can't go to the home or the office of a judge or a jury member to influence, to protest, to influence their decision. You can't influence a judge or a jury member while they're deciding a case.
And the Biden administration encouraged that, and it still does.
In fact, the Attorney General Merrick Garland has, despite the clear federal law on this matter, has said that he will not do any prosecutions or protests at the homes of justices so long as they are, quote, peaceful. We're not going to determine where they can protest, just that they maintain peace. But look, it is a violation of basic rights and law to be screaming at 3 a.m. and keeping everyone on a residential block awake. They should be arrested for disorderly conduct. If they want to protest, Lord knows there's all sorts of places in Washington, D.C. where it's perfectly legal and permissible to protest without putting personal pressure on a judge before he or she renders a decision. Look, they don't even know what the decision really is going to be. It could change. As I say, this is just a draft opinion.
Right.
And also, there could be concurrences which sort of modify the full impact of this decision. So we don't really know the nuances. They're still debating it. Well, it could be a totally different decision. People could change their minds between February and now. Sure. Not to mention the fact that concurring opinions could put a modifier or a qualification on the decision. People have no clue at this point with certainty, but they are reacting as if, the sky is falling. Now, I am a big believer in abortion rights, but in a sense, the way the Supreme Court is treated and understood is an even more important issue, because all of our rights are protected by the Supreme Court. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the right to a jury trial, on and on and on. Right. All of these rights now are what? Subject to the same political pressure of Congress people face. That would be a total change of our Constitution and a very negative move, in my view.
Right.
I think they also wanted to affect the dynamics of the upcoming election.
Well, I believe that's certainly the motive why it was leaked.
Yes. I mean, it could theoretically have been a conservative clerk or something trying to influence others, but I doubt it.
It doesn't. That doesn't strike me as Although I'm no fan of conservatives either. But
They both get it wrong, frankly, on constitutional philosophy.
Yes, they do.
So
are you there?
So James, how do they get it right then? So when you have to tell them.
Well, as I just indicated, the Bill of Rights set up a very limited representative government. A government that would have very limited powers. And in the first article of the Constitution, as it was originally drafted way back, and adopted way back in 1789, was they listed specifically the powers that the government would have. And there was a debate over whether or not to include a Bill of Rights at all. And Alexander Hamilton, for example, said, well, if we list the rights, then people will think that the freedoms and rights of the people are just limited to this list. Whereas we listed the powers. So where did it say in our list of powers that they could do a censorship or establish a religion, for example? So it would be dangerous to include a Bill of Rights. Well, the advocates like Thomas Jefferson, who said, no, we've got to have a Bill of Rights that protects freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and the right to a jury trial and so on. Well, what we'll do is we'll fix it by including the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. And the Ninth Amendment says that the enumeration, the naming, the listing, of certain rights in this Constitution should not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So in other words, the Bill of Rights was meant to not be an exclusive list. Or look at it this way. They're telling us to read the Bill of Rights broadly, widely, just as broadly as the language. The language says you have a right to life, liberty, and property. That's pretty broad language. A right to the free exercise of your religious beliefs. A right to free speech. Well, that's big, broad language, and they meant that to be interpreted broadly. They had the 10th Amendment. The 10th Amendment said that any powers not granted to the government by this Constitution are reserved to the people of the states. That meant the list of the powers was to be read narrowly, that if we tell you that you have a power, read that very narrowly, and any procedures for regulating that power, read that narrowly. But of course, the Bill of Rights at first only applied against the federal government. The southern states had slavery, for example, until the Civil War. And in the wake of the Civil War, we passed amendments to the Constitution, importantly, the 13th, which banned slavery everywhere, and furthermore, the 14th Amendment. Now, the 14th Amendment has several components. It was designed to protect the rights of the newly freed slaves of the South, but the language was much broader than that. It said that no state could deprive any person of the equal protection of the laws within their jurisdiction. It further said that the privileges and immunities of the citizens of the United States were also to be protected against the states. That is, the states could not violate their own citizens' rights as protected by the federal Bill of Rights. So now the federal Bill of Rights was intended by the authors of the 14th Amendment back in around 1870 to apply the Bill of Rights against the states. They had another clause, the Due Process Clause, which was meant to protect procedural rights. You can't be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Well, the history goes like this. The Supreme Court immediately gutted the Privileges and Immunities Clause. The Supreme Court immediately said, that's not what they meant. The states can still have established religion or violate your free speech. It depends on state constitutions. Furthermore, They destroyed the Equal Protection Clause. In 1892, the famous Plessy, infamous Plessy versus Ferguson case, they said, yeah, equal protection doesn't mean the Southern states can't do separate if so long as it's equal. When is separate ever equal? Which justified Jim Crow laws for the next several decades in the South, right?
Yeah.
It was only in 1954 that the Supreme Court overturned that and when Brown versus Board of Education and said, no. Separate is not separate, but equal. Equal is equal, and people have to be treated. All persons get the should have the equal protection of the law, including against the Kansas School Board, which that case was against. But through the course of the 20th century, the Supreme Court has, piece by piece, in a piecemeal way, enforced the Bill of Rights against the states. They did say, but they're using the Due Process Clause, which was never intended to do that. So starting in the 1920s, the Supreme Court began to say, no, freedom of speech, no state can limit, can censor you. And then they began to increase until by the 1960s, criminal procedure was basically federalized using the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, your right to counsel, your right to remain silent, which are protected in the Federal Bill of Rights against the federal government's violating it, is now enforced against the states, so that the states have to give you all the rights in effect. But that took case by case, slowly through the Due Process Clause. Now, in the course of that, the Due Process Clause was expanded to include, this is what they call substantive due process. Curious phrase, right?
Mm.
The Due Process Clause was then taken on a whole new meaning. And so other liberties, these other liberties that the Ninth Amendment or the Privileges and Immunities Clause were meant to include could now come in through the back door of the Due Process Clause. And this included what the Supreme Court started to define in the late 60s as the right to privacy. In 1968, there was a famous case, Griswold versus Connecticut.
Right.
A married couple wanted to get birth control from their doctor, who was happy to prescribe it to them. They had had children. They just didn't want any more children. They wanted to get the new birth control pill. And Connecticut had laws, religiously motivated laws, saying that no one could acquire birth control, even by prescription from a licensed doctor, even if you were a married couple. And so the Supreme Court said, no. There's a basic marital right to privacy, and that means the right to get birth control. And so in Griswold versus Connecticut, they recognized a right to privacy in 1968. Well, a few years later, in the case of Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court said, well, that includes the right of the woman to have an abortion in the first trimester of pregnancy. And that, of course, set off a firestorm of conservative opposition. And in fact, it helped focus the conservatives to create their own sort of judicial philosophy in response to Roe versus Wade. They said, look, abortion is not anywhere mentioned in the Constitution.
Is that called originalism or what is that?
Exactly. Yeah. And so the idea was that if abortion had not been included and anticipated by the framers of the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, that the Supreme Court should leave it to the states and democracy. And they were claiming that they were advocates of democracy. But of course, they were writing out of existence the true intent of the framers, as you could read it in the Ninth Amendment, right? Or you could read it in the framers of the 14th Amendment. You go back to the people in Congress who wrote the draft, the language of the 14th Amendment, they meant to include, and they said this in their debates, the right to marry and have children, the right to get a job, the right to open a business, the right to travel freely, the right to sue and be sued, all these, and they included, and a whole bunch of other stuff, all of the normal and natural liberties that the people of America should expect. And that was the scope of the intent of the framers of the 14th Amendment. But conservatives say, no. If it's not explicitly in the Constitution, like a right to abortion or a right to birth control, then the states have a right to regulate it through their democratic auspices. The liberals didn't like that. But the liberals, of course, read the powers broadly. Over the course of the 20th century, they began to read things like the Interstate Commerce Clause, which was only meant to be able to regulate trains and ferries that actually carried stuff between the states. And the original intent of that was to stop states from regulating trade and putting up trade barriers between each other. So for the first half of our country's history, the Interstate Commerce Clause was only used by the Supreme Court to strike down state laws that interfered with state-to-state commerce. It was not used as a positive power by the federal government until well into the 19th century. And even then, the Supreme Court said it's very limited to trains and things to actually transport the material. But by the middle of the 20th century, it began to, Congress was given the power through that clause, as if they struck out the word interstate, right? Yeah. To regulate even small businesses in the middle of Texas. Famous case, Ollie's Chicken Farm in the middle of Texas. He did all his business in Texas. He did no trade with any other state. But because of his impact on the national economy, poor little Ollie's Chicken Farm, even though he did absolutely zero trade with other states and transported nothing to other states or brought in supplies from other states even, it was still construed to be interstate commerce. So the left wants to construe the powers broadly. Right. And the right wants to construe the liberties narrowly. So the very fear that our founding fathers had, the very fear is now incorporated and embodied by each side. Each side takes the fallacious position feared by one side or the other of the founding fathers. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And rather than having judicial activism out of control, what we have seen since the 14th Amendment, in my mind, is total judicial abdication when it comes to protecting the liberties of Americans. Only through the back door, I give them some credit for protecting the Bill of Rights against the states, slowly in a piecemeal and in an awkward form and through a clause that was never intended to bear all that load. But it is through the due process clause that Roe versus Wade was decided. Now, of course, since Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court has further expanded this right to privacy. When it was first, America had sodomy laws, and that was upheld by the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court said, well, this isn't within the, there's no right to sexual privacy within the Constitution. And whether you're gay or straight or anyone else, Georgia can regulate sodomy. Well, that was the Bowers-Hardwick decision in 1982, which was overturned a little more than 10 years ago in the Lawrence decision, which said, no. People have a right to engage in privacy of their own home, sex with other consenting adults. And that's that. That's part of the right to privacy. And that was quickly expanded to include the right to gay marriage. Under the Equal Protection Clause, if you're going to license marriage between heterosexual couples, they can't deprive that. Because remember, the 14th Amendment says all persons are protected in their equal protection of the law. Not just men, not just women, not just blacks and whites, all persons get the equal protection of laws of the state. And so I believe that all of that is now on the chopping block if Roe versus Wade is overturned. So although I feel very strongly about a woman's right to abortion, it should be through the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which could bear that load constitutionally under the original intent, as far as I'm concerned, of the 14th and 9th Amendments, and our basic right to liberty as protected in the 5th and 14th Amendments. But that, you see, would be the correct way to have decided this. And the Supreme Court got off to an unsure footing on this from the start. And both political sides just get it wrong.
I was reading the other day something that made sense to me. Now, since you were a lawyer,
yeah, for almost 18 years, I was a public prosecutor. Murder cases, yeah.
this article says that Lochner was the progressive's blank check to control the economy.
Yeah. It was the turning point. It was the key change that sort of altered federal power as such. But that really only, it was the famous case of FDR trying to pack the court in the late 1930s.
Right.
So it didn't work for him that way, but he eventually did get in enough justices to completely Frankfurter and his crew so that through the 1940s and 1950s, the doctrine of expanding based on Lochner, the doctrine that started expanding federal government's power became established law. But Lochner was the case, that put the idea into the bloodstream of our constitutional law.
So Roe v. Wade may be the conservatives' counterpunch.
as it were, you see. And see, before this, what was interesting is that the federal government was limited in its economic power through the Due Process Clause. The left, the progressives, despised that. When the Supreme Court would say, well, the Due Process Clause prevents the government from engaging in certain economic regulations, the left just went crazy. Well, the Supreme Court stopped doing that, but then shifted over to using the Due Process Clause to protect what's known as civil liberties. So there's this bizarre contradiction where economic liberties are, of course, systematically ignored by the left, whereas personal liberties are systematically ignored by the right. And both sides say, well, you know, I'm reading the Constitution. I don't see a right to engage in monopoly. Well, again, that's or again, it's just like the right saying, I don't see a right to birth control or abortion, you know, or sexual yes. privacy in the Constitution. They're both reading the Constitution specifically in a way that the framers did not feared and did not want. The very fears of the founding fathers are being concretely realized in our time.
The way that this article put it was that the conservatives have done a bait and switch on originalism, that the natural law, if you will, or rule of law, is now going to be overturned by tradition.
One of the distressing parts of the draft decision that was leaked, and as I say, the leak itself is at least as important as any substantive decision that the Supreme Court
yes. makes.
They can always change their mind, and they're there to protect all our liberties. So the leak, I do not mean to sanction the leak in saying this and using the leaked material in my own analysis, but I did read the entire draft opinion. And one of the most distressing things about the conservative draft opinion that explicitly overturns Roe versus Wade, saying that there's no right to abortion mentioned in the Constitution, is tradition. Mm-hmm. It uses tradition and history to trump big, broad liberal language. In you know, the framers used that language, as I say, precisely because they knew they could not anticipate future violate censorship, forms of censorship, or violations of liberty. That's why they understood that they were including things they could not and did not anticipate.
That word is unenumerated, correct?
Unenumerated. That's that. And the Ninth Amendment couldn't make it any more explicit, right?
Yeah.
So, yes. James?
Big broad language, right?
Go ahead, Martin.
Did they even mention the Judeo-Christian tradition?
That's it.
They did?
It was quite distressing, for example, versus Hardwick, the 82 decision that first upheld. Rehnquist used the same thing. The Judeo-Christian tradition of morality was what he cited to trump the liberty language in the Constitution. And so it wasn't a constitutional analysis. It was analysis of the traditional morality of the Western mind. And so Alito says, wait a minute, going back, and he literally goes back to the Middle Ages, citing tradition on abortion and when life begins. And Christian moralists dating to the medieval times in Europe, he cited as part of the moral tradition about abortion and abortion laws.
Could you then, James, mention a little bit, and then Blair will continue, about Rand's position on this and why it's so important and crucial issue? And she mentioned, for example, Ronald Reagan again, and we will include this in the show notes about the stance here about this issue. And also, I will really look into that. That will keep an eye on this issue and the politicians, because now we really see what they are trying to do. So
yeah,
please, James.
Politically speaking, just as a historian, politically speaking is a very interesting history here. The Democrats were the party of slavery, the South, and Jim Crow.
Yep.
And it was the Republicans who gave America the 13th, 14th Amendment, the amendment that gave women the right to vote. It was a Republican Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. A Republican governor of California was appointed by the Republican President Eisenhower, and his name was Earl Warren, and he wrote the Brown versus Board of Education decision. So until the 1960s, the Democrats, being dependent upon votes from the South to get any president elected, were totally in the pocket of the Southern segregationists. It was only in the 1960s that starting with John Kennedy primarily, and so I have to give him some credit, even though he was obviously a closet fascist, more than a closet fascist, right? But he changed the Democratic Party on the issue of race, and Martin Luther King sunk that in. Does that make sense? And so the South was sort of beginning to become up for grabs politically. And Richard Nixon had a Southern strategy.
That's right. I was going to mention that word, the Southern strategy of Nixon.
And he won a big landslide for re-election based on that. And then Ronald Reagan won a big landslide in 1980 And both gentlemen, Republicans, appealed to the South, and the South has now become comfortably a Republican stronghold, as opposed to a, although there are still some purple states there, as opposed to a Democrat. Why? They didn't appeal to racism. They appealed to religious values. And one of the things that gave them oomph and great ammunition was the Roe versus Wade decision from the early 70s. Now the religious conservatives, the Southern Baptists, for example, the largest denomination of Christians in my country, very much, along with the Catholic Church, obviously, joined forces in opposing abortion as such. An organization was started called the Moral Majority by a Southern evangelist named Jerry Falwell. And Ronald Reagan, before he ran for president, first in 76 and then in 1980, started to embrace very tightly this Moral Majority organization that thought that Christian moral values should be part of the law, including school prayer. And so when Ronald Reagan came in, he said he had, you know, opposed abortion, although his nominees to the Supreme Court pretty much upheld abortion, although I think Bork would have, if had he gotten there, would have been otherwise. But Ronald Reagan nonetheless advocated school prayer, even in government schools, where the Supreme Court has said no, teachers cannot lead students in school prayer in government-funded schools. And so that was a turn, and a turn that other Republicans were distressed at, including Senator Barry Goldwater, who, when he retired, warned the Republican Party, just as Ayn Rand had, against turning into religious conservatives instead of liberty conservatives. But since then, it's only gotten worse. And the Republican Party has more and more embraced what they call Judeo-Christian traditional moral values, which they claim the United States was based on. And of course, that's a total lie. That's exactly wrong. I would direct you to my own article in the Objective Standard, The American Revolution versus the New Testament.
Great. Now, help me with the quote that I love from Barry Goldwater that is, it should be repeated as often as humanly possible. I can't remember all of it, but it starts with extremism in defense of liberty is no vice.
There's no
in defense of liberty is no vice.
No vice, and moderation in the defense of justice is no virtue. But something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
I can't, right. Moderation in pursuing justice is no virtue. Extremism in protecting liberty is no vice. Yeah. Poor Barry Goldwater, of course, was accused of being an extremist. And Ayn Rand took that opportunity in 1964 to make a point about the term extremism. It's a total anti-concept and a smear. It implies that anyone who has an extreme view is some kind of terrorist or advocates violence or is some kind of Nazi. But if I'm an extreme advocate of liberal democracy, individual rights, if I want to be extremely happy, if I want my country to be extremely prosperous, what's wrong with that? And so extremism is just this ridiculous anti-concept, as Ayn Rand pointed out, designed to smear.
Let's jump off topic just for a minute, because I want to get your thoughts on this. America began as a constitutionally limited republic, the limits on the government, not on the people. How did it descend into democracy, mob rule?
It was an intellectual thing that preceded the legal thing, for sure.
Sure.
The intellectual coming of progressivism at the turn of the 20th century. Both Republicans and Democrats, to differing degrees, were affected by a new philosophy that said that the founding fathers. There were intellectuals, like historians, Charles Beard, for example, who said, well, the founding fathers can't be trusted. You know, they were only out to protect their economic interests.
Right, yeah.
Therefore, we can't really trust them. The idea of natural rights, the idea of Lockean rights or Jeffersonian rights was being explicitly questioned. And more socialism was coming into the fore. We need a planned economy. We don't need a government that's hamstrung by this limited government thingy the framers gave us. And so it was philosophical in its ultimate roots. Even these intellectuals were depending on deeper philosophical changes happening to America. And I would cite what Leonard Peikoff cites in The Ominous Parallels, a wave of German philosophy, of collectivist, mystic, philosophy from Germans. It started as early as American Transcendentalism, but it began to really, by the end of the 19th century, you began to see in pragmatism and other philosophical schools a direct influence. Think of pragmatism. It gets people thinking away from principles. And it's an anti-principle philosophy that became the dominant philosophy among American academic philosophers by the turn of the 20th century. Men like John Dewey and William James were advocating pragmatism. And that pragmatism was sinking in, as I say, to other intellectuals like historian Charles Beard. And that was trickling down into the legal system. And so you began to have justices like Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., who began to change American law in a very negative direction, starting in the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're looking for?
Yes, yes, thank you. That's a perfect summation of...
And thanks for that history lesson, and also, link it to our discussion, James. So we'll come back later on as a wrap-up on how valuable this content and information and the conversation is. So
Right. Thanks, James, let's just talk about the Roe versus Wade decision itself. Did you see that as as far as objectivism or objectivists were concerned, that is a major victory for individual rights?
Indeed. I say that even though the protection of free speech against the states was done on a legally shaky basis, i.e. the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment.
Right.
An immunities clause. Nonetheless, that's an important right that's being protected against states being violated. So, I am a big advocate. I think it's a very fundamental right that women have. Ayn Rand certainly believed it. The fact is, we're talking about a woman's life, we're talking about her whole life. We're talking about a life decision. And if she has to carry a baby to term, her body is going to change. If she has to make a decision as to whether or not to, she's created a life that she's morally responsible for and throw it out there either for adoption or spend the rest of her life now as a mother concerned and responsible for her offspring. The only responsible, think of the moral responsibility that's being imposed by making someone have a baby against their will. You're sort of commandeering their entire life. And so women who want careers, or say women who've already had enough children that they can handle. This is as many children as I can handle. And there was a failure in birth control or something. No, you still got to have that baby. And Ayn Rand would say, wait a minute here. When we're talking about a microorganism for the first weeks, when we're talking about an inky dinky piece of protoplasm, in the first few weeks of pregnancy here, there can be no moral issue. But more than that, I myself, and I think objectivism implies this more broadly, it really doesn't matter the status of the fetus, although Ayn Rand stressed that surely some entity incapable of life outside of her womb has no natural right to life. It's still part of her. It's not an independent entity at all.
True.
More than that, even if you, Blair, now you're a mature man like myself, and you've got every right in the book, the right to vote, the right to engage in contracts. Well, let's say somehow you took residence in my body. You know, like that old science fiction movie where they shrink that ship with Raquel Welch in it so they could do the surgery. Fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Let's imagine that they could shrink you and put you into my body. Would I have a right to evict you from my body at any time? I would.
Sure you would.
If I have a right to evict trespassers or burglars from my home, they don't have a right to just start raiding my fridge and living in my bedroom, do they?
No.
So if I have a right to evict people from my home, surely I have an even more important right to evict even fully grown adult people who have every right in the book from my body. And I would say that even if that means the death of the other person, because it's my body. So in that sense, the status of the fetus is really irrelevant in my view. Although I think there could be a moral issue, there certainly could be a moral issue.
Yes.
Right to remove another person from the, even if it is another person, you see, a right to remove another person from their body is a right in my view. When it comes to a pre-viable fetus, They can't even survive outside of the woman's womb. To claim it has a right to life seems utterly bizarre to me, a right that nature would deny it outside of her womb. It obviously is still part of her body, and she has a right to remove it, like she has a right to remove one of her kidneys, even though her kidney is a living human thing, right?
Okay. So,
to compare a woman's whole life and happiness, and that's what we're talking about here, a woman's entire life and happiness versus, let's say, a pre-viable fetus, which is what the right is protected under current law, it's not even an issue in my mind. It can't even be a moral issue for a pre-viable fetus. A woman, the life of a fully born human being certainly takes independent living entity, certainly takes precedence over a piece of protoplasm that can't live outside of her uterus. And that's all Roe versus Wade said. It was modified in a later decision, the Casey decision, because the original Roe decision had broken things up by trimester. It said in the first trimester, she's got an absolute right. But in the last trimester, the state can regulate it for the health of the fetus as well as the mother. And Casey comes along and says, no, the line is undue burden on the right, and the line is really viability. A pre-viable fetus, a woman has a right to terminate the pregnancy of. And that's the current law. So it's not as though it's a crazy law that allows states not to regulate abortion in the 8th and 9th month. It does not. Our current law only gives the absolute right to a woman prior to viability, which only happens even with all of our great medical technology. And they sort of reached a wall here that they can't go much past 20 some weeks. So, and even those are, you know, oftentimes questionable whether the child will live outside the woman, but surely the viability doesn't happen until 20 some weeks. And in my mind, there can't even be a moral issue in those cases.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Let's just sum up this the first 45 minutes. Then, philosophically, you were correct in mentioning the German school philosophers, and I consider Hegel, Kant, Marx, and whoever the fourth famous German philosopher might be as the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Well, it could be Fichte.
It could be Fichte.
Or even Nietzsche, right?
It could be Nietzsche, yes.
Nietzsche was no socialist, but he was, you know, an advocate of the magnificent blonde brute stepping over dead bodies.
Yeah, so I think Hitler took a heart. Nonetheless.
Nonetheless.
I'm going to my personal view is that philosophy, the betrayal of reason, the wallowing in emotions is what led to the conservatives crawling out from under the rock, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
In the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, well, the neo-mystics were liberated, weren't they, by philosophy? Yeah. It was serious academic philosophers, men allegedly of the Enlightenment, starting with Kant, who opened the bottle, let the genie out of total irrationalism. The philosophical movement known as Romanticism, not the artistic movement, the philosophical movement of Romanticism that led out of the genie bottle there, the evil power of neo-mysticism and its will and instinct, and men like Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, for example, and overt irrationalism and overt neo-mysticism. And logic was being assaulted. Hegel came out and attacked Aristotle's, correspondence theory of truth. Subjectivism began to rule the day. There's Marx's polylogism, which attacked Aristotelian logic and said we really can't ever think outside of our social class box in a kind of deterministic way. Although Marx himself, of course, came from the middle class, so I guess one could suppose from his own logic that Marxism was bourgeois logic that we can dismiss. But you're right. It was this neo-mysticism. And now in the 20th century, whether you look at academics on the left or academics on the right, they're just sort of picking their forms of neo-mysticism. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. The last topic I want to discuss, and we're coming up on an hour, so.
Oh, dear.
That's all right. That's all right.
That's all good.
My word. I do ramble on, don't I?
No, it's not. I'm not complaining. I'm just, we like to keep our show between a certain time, because I think it's easier for listeners. That's the only reason. But so I'm not condemning you or complaining about your whatever you said. So please don't think that. I want to discuss the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, attack on Disney. Now, I believe, not in fact, I'm certain that since corporations are consist of individual human beings, the corporation has a right to free speech, just as an individual does, mm-hmm. even if they're wrong, so to speak. Yeah. And what I didn't understand about this particular thing about Disney is what they, I think it's called special privilege or special something.
Oh, yeah.
Disney itself was granted the right or to police itself, to tax itself.
They got their own government in Florida.
They have their own, right.
And Walt Disney was planning, you know, he built Disneyland in California where he lived and had Disney Studios. But he wanted a much bigger and grander facility that, you know, he envisioned things like Epcot and so forth, right? And so he said, where will I build this? And states literally went around shopping it, and states were offering him perks and privileges. And one of the things he got is when he bought this big, vast tract of land near Orlando, Florida, the state of Florida actually said, you can run your own government, and you'll have certain tax privileges. You can have your own police department. No kidding, though. Disneyland was sort of allowed to govern Disney World in Florida and given special privileges to do so. Their own cops, their own tax system. And so in the initial bit of it, I might complain that it was, in effect, corporate welfare, kind of cronyism. And so the initial privileges, you know, why does Disney have these special privileges over and against any other entertainment corporation in America? It was special perks they got. And in effect, Disney World Florida is its own government. And so one can question the favors in the first place. But the motive that DeSantis has is absolutely, you're absolutely right. It's somewhat despicable to me. They disagree with his law, right, about public education and gender education. And I mean, for myself, do I think that kindergartners and first graders, should they be taught about gender? No. I'm not even sure how it comes up with first grader.
My goodness, yeah.
And it wasn't a don't say gay law. But again, it's when you have public education, you are necessarily going to impose values. And the state has no business educating children in values one way or another. So public education inherently has this problem. Inherently imposes one set of values or another. In any case, one could say that whatever the regulation is, if we had no public education, which we should have no public education, then the government would have no role in regulating what's taught to kindergartners, first graders, and second graders about sex. So even if in the abstract I would say, yeah, I don't want my first grader taught about gender identity, on the other hand, I don't think the government should be educating kids at all, and that it should be up to the parents to determine how their children are educated and when their children are educated about sex between them and whatever school or teacher they hire. So the whole thing is fully wrinkled with all kinds of complexities that should not be there. But the motive that DeSantis had in removing Disney's special privileges was simply because people at Disney were complaining and Disney took a stand that said, we oppose this law. Of course, Disney has the right to free speech. It's so funny these days. It's the liberals who are defending corporations who often take, you know, very liberal and woke positions. Their free speech is if liberals who used to, for most of my youth and childhood, it was the left that complained about corporate, quote, censorship, when there's no such thing as corporate censorship, right? Only government censorship. You know, like the Disinformation Bureau that just fell apart. Right?
Yes.
That would be government censorship, real censorship. Yes. Whereas, you know, saying that Disney is going to get punished because it takes a certain political stance against DeSantis seems to me to be the very kind of removal of a political favor, just as the granting of a political favor to a corporation is corrupt. So the threat to remove it is in itself almost corrupt, even though the thing shouldn't exist at all.
Okay. Yeah, it does in a way. I didn't think of it that way, actually.
And that's why I kind of look at it.
Yeah, and if I don't want to go to the amusement park, I don't have to do that. And, of course, Disney could move to another state. So
exactly.
If you, and that could be a follow-up, James. Where is the so-called freest state in the United States of America? Is that New Hampshire, live free or die, or where is it right now?
Good. Alaska does pretty good. New Hampshire does pretty good. The Dakotas aren't so bad. Wyoming's not so bad. Comparatively, as big states go, Texas and Florida actually are. I mean, they're two of the top populated states. And believe it or not, Florida has a bigger population than New York State does now. So it's one of the, Texas and Florida, two of the, I think, top five or 10 population states, and they're among the freer states. But that number of states where there's even and I look at things like, is there an income tax? Well, in places like Nevada and Texas and Florida, Wyoming, there is no income tax, for example. And when you look at the COVID lockdowns, I think that was another good test. Places like the Dakotas and Wyoming, and at least earlier than other states, Florida lifted the most onerous restrictions, as did Texas.
Right.
You know, Tennessee was good too. A lot of people are moving to Tennessee.
That's true. I loved living in Nashville when I did. That really does it for me, Mark. Do you want to take over?
Yes, a little wrap-up. And thanks again for this. It's so great. And this coming into then Value for Value and Podcasting 2.0 initiative. So we will do here a call to action, and that's that you go to Fountain, and that's a new podcast app. And they have now a campaign, so I will include that in the show notes. Okay. So if you support this show, do that by download a free app called Fountain and then send us a boost. And a boost is like a donation through something called Satoshis. And that and Satoshi is a part of a Bitcoin. And then we will pick in every episode here a boost. And the person who have done that comment and so on will be able to win 50,000 satoshis.
Wow.
And it could be like a question to James, it could be a comment, it could be something that you learned, or a thank you. And then also I will include then in the, so it will be easy for you to do that, and then you go to fountain.fm/Lyceum, and that's my username, and there we could connect and so on, and then you could start streaming Satoshis and support content creators and independent podcasters like ourselves. And also we could also do something that I will include in the show notes, an article about share earnings with co-hosts, guests and good causes. So for example, if you set up a node like Freedom of Expression, you could support that if the show is spreading the good word. And also a guest could get a part of it because you draw attention, you get downloads, you spread the good word. So I see this as a really interesting development. And the good thing is that no middleman, no big brother, no state, whatever, could stop this. So,
I hope you're right.
I can only say, please do it. Please download the free Fountain app and do consider. I mean, the work that Martin and Blair do, I think, is of enormous value. And I'm not just including my appearances. I think
you should. You should, James.
Yes, sure. I think that they're doing really good work. And thanks. If you like the kind of content that you heard here today, please do consider what Martin is saying here. Download that free app and do consider helping out here. It's important work.
Thanks, James.
Thank you. Thank you, James. All right. Well, once again, I'd love to sign off by saying, James, thanks for manning the foxhole with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime, guys.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye. Take care, James.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.